attempting to wrest my radio show away from him, and I have I have achieved mastery.
Oh boy!
Okay. Very funny, Ethan Bowling. Is our producer. And here today on this fine Tuesday afternoon, Tuesday evening, with Mr. Tom McDonald. Mm-hmm. And of course, the big discussion on everyone's mind, steeped as we are in biblical lore and literacy, I think the question, you know, that has certainly been dominating the headlines since last night is... Do Melania Trump and Michelle Obama both owe a debt to the Q source? I think that's a real question.
Owe a debt to who? Oh, the Q source, yes. Well, I think we need to do some textual criticism on this and try to tease out the layers, you know, of influence of text and try to reconstruct a lost presidential first lady text, the text, we can call it.
Yes.
Yeah, I think we need to reconvene the Jesus seminar for this. Let me get Marcus Borg involved. Oh, he's dead. Never mind.
You can do all of those things. Yes, so for those of you who did not punish yourself by watching the Republican National Convention, three more nights of which a battered nation has yet to endure. Melania Trump gave a speech yesterday in which she very obvious. Well, it's too generous to say that she plagiarized Michelle Obama. Whoever wrote her speech for her.
Oh, I think it was deliberate. I think they've got a mole on the inside to make her look foolish because it was so obvious. She rickrolled the audience. Did you notice?
Yes, that was the other thing. That was the that I loved. Yes, whoever wrote the speech did two things. One was they went out and they plagiarized the speech that Michelle Obama gave at the 2008 Democratic Convention.
And just a more pap and empty speech you could not have imagined. Just one long knee of cliches. You know?
That was the fun part was, you know, it was like, my word is my bond, she says as she plagiarizes.
Which was funny because when she came out there and started talking, I'm not making fun of her accent much, but she sounded and looked exactly like a Bond girl. You know, she should have entered to Bond theme music.
She does indeed look like a Bond girl. You're right. And but anyway, so for those of you who are not up to, on the super granular nitinoid stuff about biblical criticism, there has been a longstanding theory that there are two basic sources that are being used by gospel writers. One of them is the Gospel of Mark. So when we talk about gospel writers, we mean Matthew and Luke. So the theory is that Matthew and Luke have in front of them Mark's gospel or some prototype of Mark's gospel that will eventually become Mark's gospel. And then another document, which is known in German as the Source or Quelle document, or for short, Q. And this has been a long-standing...
Is that what it means? I thought it was named after that all-powerful character in Star Trek Next Generation.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Because it's about as plausible as that character.
Well, that's the problem, is that the Q has not fared well recently in biblical criticism. But all of this is super inside baseball if you happen to be interested in how do we get the Gospels and so on and so forth. So my little joke was simply that... Melania and Michelle are both relying on the Q source. It's a feeble joke, but a poor thing.
It's a feeble election.
Poor thing, but mine own. And so, and what I can always do is I can just say that I didn't actually come up with that joke myself. I actually stole it from a reader, but it really killed me when I read it. So I just had to throw it out there because...
Wait. You have a joke on plagiarism that you plagiarized?
I'm giving full attribution here.
Oh my gosh. The meta issues just fold in on each other and create a kind of loop.
So there we are. And of course, the other awesome thing that just really, I loved this was and again, getting super meta, when Trump's third wife rickrolls an entire nation by saying he's never going to let you down, he's never going to give you up. it was like, that's just too awesome for words. That
could not have been an accident. Somebody was writing that speech at some point. Perhaps they were half in the bag and they just threw that in and it never got cut back out. See, I know what it's like putting gags in early drafts of things. I've done it and I've actually seen them get through. Sometimes I would put a joke in for an editor I knew and then the editor forgot to take it out.
Yeah.
When we were making magazines and the magazines were, we were on a pretty fast schedule. So I'm like, oh, you were supposed to take that out.
Oops.
Yeah, so that's how I envision the whole rickrolling thing, and maybe the Trump, the Obama thing was, again, placeholder, because it's so banal. It's like, say something like, you know, if you dream it, you can be it. Nobody would plagiarize that deliberately. Nobody would look at that and say, that needs to be, you know, I need to put that in my mouth. Because well, that just rolls around like, you know, like Coleridge.
The interesting thing to me, and this is something that Michael Gerson, who was Bush's speechwriter, said that what he sees in this, I mean, this, I think that this is all hilarious, and this all has, you know, the weight and gravitas of a feather, of course, in the grand scheme of things. But what Gerson sees in this, and I think is very true, is this says to him, massive laziness and disorganization in the Trump campaign organization that something like this could have happened.
Oh yeah.
And that I think is pretty obvious that this is it's a miracle that this campaign has succeeded, because, you know, this is a guy who he's not paying attention. He doesn't care. It was just, you know, go say something beautiful, you know?
Right. Right.
And so she did, and, you know, and then they issued the statements. And today, I mean, you know, what's unbelievable is the response of the Trump organization was to blame Hillary.
How did they work that one out?
Oh, who knows? You know, I mean, they just say anything, you know. And but you know, his fanboys will all buy that, and because has he ever been wrong? And so anyway, it's just this. I think rickrolling America is just an awesome achievement. And my hat is off to whoever wrote that speech.
Yeah, I got to say, I like it. It's one of the lighter and more amusing things in this dismal election. And by the way, we have to pause and consider the fact that this man child, this very weird, crass joke of a candidate is neck and neck with a dead heat currently with the Democratic nominee. What does that say about Hillary?
I know.
People despise her so much that they'd look at this cartoon character and say, well that's at least he's not her.
Yeah, it's amazing to me. They both seem to be, it's, you know, I, part of my one of my theories, which I'm going to stick to until it's proven that it's not true, is that this is a huge experiment by Kang and Kodos to see who can run the campaign that is most guaranteed to drive people toward the opposite person. That just seems to be how they're both running. It's just unbelievable to me, but yeah.
Yeah. No, so, I think I'll just vote for the conservative.
The thing that I was watching, I watched some of the speeches yesterday, and the speeches kept saying, you know, our allies are appalled by our weakness and et cetera and et cetera. And I put a thing on Facebook going, specifically sort of aiming at my non-American readers, saying, which of our allies exactly are longing for Donald Trump to be president of the United States? The chorus of crickets was really, really loud. It was like, there's nobody out there.
The only people are the press, because they'll have 4 years of great material. You know.
Well, it would be funny, you know, if it weren't so terrifying. But
yeah, I think I'm just going to go down ticket and vote for Daryl Castle from the Constitution Party, you know, and just be done with it.
But that is,
you're not supposed to. He's okay. Gary Johnson without the weed.
All right. Well, that sounds like a reason. Yeah, I mean, I'm going to vote for a third party guy too, whoever that is.
Which is also a Kang and Kodos joke. I'll teach you. I'll vote for a third party. Go ahead.
Throw away your
which vote. I hear routinely from my family. I'm being chastised for saying I will not vote for Trump because it'll just put Hillary in the White House. And I said, first of all, I live in New Jersey. We'll lose the state anyway. And second,
here is the answer to that. That whole that because you always hear that you hear that and you hear that whoever you're talking about, I will explain when we return why you're not giving your vote to somebody besides the person you're voting for. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here today with Tom McDonald. We'll be back talking about the fathers of the church and stuff.
You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
To Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here with Tom McDonald and just talking about the, you know, one of the things you always hear when you say you're going to vote for a third party is if you vote for a third party, then you're really voting for whoever it is your interlocutor doesn't want you to vote for. So if you're talking to somebody who is a Trump supporter and you say you're going to vote for a third party, you're really voting for Hillary. If you talk for you hear the same thing, you know, from Hillary supporters, if you vote third party, you're really giving your vote to Trump. Here's why this is a lie. The lie that behind this is that the rejected candidate that one of the two major party candidates has by divine right a right to your vote, which you are denying them. And when you deny them that vote that has been granted them by God Almighty, then you're actually really giving your vote to the other candidate. Well, of course, in point of fact, neither candidate has been granted your vote by God Almighty. both of them are people who are coming to you for a job, and they're juggling and they're doing handstands and they're doing whatever it is that they do to try to persuade you that you should hire them. And if you look at both of them and say, "Yeah, you both suck," I'm going to give my vote to
third party person,
Daryl Fluckenberger or whoever.
Right. it's Frank then, Fluckenberger, which is why that would be hilarious. He's not actually the candidate; he's the chairman. That's just trying to hear the media say that for 4 years would crack me up. I would vote just for the humor potential. That's the only thing with Trump that I kind of appreciate is that 4 years of Donald Trump as president stories would be hilarious.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. So anyway, that's why all that's bogus, because you do not actually owe either candidate a vote. No. And so you're not denying them anything that was theirs by right.
No, and I voted a third party about, you know, since I was able to vote about 80% of the time, roughly, let's say. You know, I've only voted for a couple of mainstream nominees because I've found them all reprehensible for the most part.
Yeah.
And I thought that and when I did pull the, well, we've got to vote for X so we don't get Y, it was George Bush, who I think was not a bad person, but was a disastrous president.
Was a disastrous president.
You know, and yeah, Obama was another disastrous president.
That's one of those weird things, in history, is just because somebody is a horrible person. Of course, this undercuts my case with Trump. Just because someone is a hideous human being doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be a bad president.
Oh, no. Bill Clinton's living proof of that.
Yeah, I mean, Bill Clinton might be
a
terrible human being, but...
short of Andrew Jackson, probably the worst man to ever actually become president, but actually a pretty competent president.
He's a pretty competent president.
You know, we can look back fondly on the 90s. Hey, remember how much better things are in the 90s? They're like, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So anyway, okay. So they had the first thing with the convention, and they're having it more again tonight. And you can watch it on TV if you're a glutton for punishment.
I must watch it on the website too. We don't have TV. We don't have cable here, so we won't.
Stephen Colbert seems to have been born for this hour. He is having a high time. He just released some amazing sort of giant dance number thing video that I just saw, which was pretty funny. And but beyond that, let's talk about fathers. You just wrote an essay.
Yeah, a little piece. Elizabeth Scalia at Alatea, which I'm not sure I'm even saying that right, had asked me to do something. That's right. On fathers, there's been some posting and talking about fathers and such. And what the basic idea is, and this is true, is that the father determines the faith practice of the children. If a mother is a regular churchgoer and the father is not, only 2% of the children will grow up to be regular churchgoers. Hmm. However, if the parents practice the faith and the father comes along with them and practices as well, 37% of the children will be regular churchgoers and 41% will be irregular churchgoers. So the number and the most bizarre fact, this was first found in a Swedish study about 20 years ago, but it's been reaffirmed since then. Okay. The most bizarre fact is that when you reverse it, when the father practices and the mother does not, remember, when that's reversed, our number is 2% of the children grow up to practice. When you reverse that and the father practices, 44% of the children grow up to become regular churchgoers, which is a mind-blowing number when you really think about it. You know, you'd think mom can take the child to mass alone every week, you know, for their entire childhood, and that child stands a 2% chance of persisting in the faith. Dad can take the child alone for the child's entire childhood, and the child stands a 44% chance of persisting in the faith. Well, that's something that requires some thought, doesn't it? You know, what does that mean? Where do we think that comes from? You know, and I've seen some interesting, Touchstone did something at the time and kind of started to, you know, vector in on an answer. But I think you have to look beyond religion, beyond sociology, just to pure psychology. I mean, we can't really be shed of Freud no matter how much we'd like to be. And I mean, it's been very hip and trendy to leave Freud behind, but he did find some fairly fundamental building blocks and engines of human behavior. And one of them was the mother-father dynamic, you know. And while we can discount the basic sexualized nature of the Oedipal theory and the rest of this, the Oedipus effect, we can look at this idea that there's an association, like a psychological association of mother, capital M, with childhood and home, and father, capital F, you know, as the idea of father, with adulthood and the world, because the father goes out into the world and represents the world coming back into us. Now, we can say that's socially constructed. If that makes people feel better, fine, whatever, you know, but that's the reality of the situation. Now, we live in a perfectly atypical home. We both work at home. My wife makes more than I do. We shared equally in the child rearing. There were times where I did more. There were times where she did more. So we have a completely atypical household. Our children have never seen what you know, dad goes out to work and mom stays home, you know, what you consider the traditional thing. But we're still a very traditional family in that sense that we stay together, we do things together, we eat a dinner together, we pray. And seeing a father pray, seeing a father carving out home time for something, namely worship, mm-hmm. has a huge effect on the psyche of a child. And we can only, yeah. I think, answer that psychologically. I'm not sure. We can, I guess, look to it on a theological angle with, you know, the spiritual headship, which I've always been, you know, not one to really give a lot of lip to that idea that the man is the spiritual head of the house. But we can look at the idea of God as Father. You know, we could look at some of these nasty patriarchal things we're supposed to discount now. But at the end, the numbers speak for themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, and it is the role of the father is so hugely important. And I think that the role of spiritual fatherhood, something interesting happened early on in my life as a Catholic. I would go to confession and for spiritual direction, and I would come home and I would talk to my wife about, you know, something that the priest had said. And I particularly noticed this with absolution in the sacrament. My first few experiences in particular of the sacrament of confirmation were enormously powerful to me. You know, when the priest, as it happened, the priest don't always do this, of course, but, you know, in this case, the priest put his hands on my head when he granted absolution.
Right. I think you said confirmation. You meant confession.
Did I say confirmation? Yeah. I meant confession. Okay. It was hugely powerful, and words that I absolutely needed to hear them in a male voice. Now, obviously, this is not a universal thing for all people, but I would come home from confession and from spiritual direction, and I would talk about, you know, something that the priest had told me, and my wife would go, "I've been saying that to you for years." I'm like, I don't know. It just didn't get through. But somehow hearing it from a father,
right,
was hugely important. You know, that, I mean, that says an enormous amount about my psychological makeup. How much that says about everybody's, I don't know. Very, very significant, I think. Well, we'll continue this when we get back. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here today with Tom McDonald. We'll be back.
Redbox Media now is a great way for you to go deeper with your favorite show or shows in our programming lineup. With our Friend of the Show opportunity, you get extra exclusive content from your favorite show hosts and lots of extra love from the shows and hosts you love. Become a friend of the show by clicking on the link on our website or app menu. Your $10 monthly premium membership will unlock an exclusive world just for you. Support your favorite show today as a friend of the show. Friend of the Show premium memberships exclusively for you with Redbox Media.
Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today, this very day, with Tom McDonald. We've been talking a little bit about the importance of fatherhood, I think you're right that, you know, we've had a culture for a long time. What are the images of fatherhood that you see? Homer Simpson, you know.
Right. Well, I mean, it's the dumb father. I mean, people have kind of beaten it to death, but it's because it's true. The dumb father in commercials and sitcoms and shows who's, you know, always corrected by his smarter, snottier children or, you know, his long-suffering wife. You know, I guess it's supposed to be seen as a corrective where, you know, to the golden age of advertising where women would be like, no, if you really want to treat your wife right this Christmas, get her a fine new ironing board kind of thing. So I guess they figure reversing it now and kicking us is probably some kind of justice. I don't know. That's a leftist mindset that I can't grasp. But the thing is, masculinity is not necessarily, and we kind of talked, I talked about this in an essay I wrote for, I wish I remember the name of it. It was a book edited by Brandon McGinley about Catholicism for Men. It might have been called Catholicism for Men, but for all I know. And I was talking about technology, but I was also talking about conventional views of manhood. Now, we were kind of talking off air, both you, me, and I was up seeing Stephen Graydonis a couple of weeks ago. And Stephen had called what we have is not having the sports gene. We have absolutely no comprehension or knowledge of sports in really any form. I played basketball because I had to, because I'm 6.5 feet tall and, you know, they wouldn't let me not, but I got out as soon as I could. And whenever someone starts in on sports, it's like, do you know the ginger effect from the Far Side? It's what you say to your dog. Oh, Fifi, you're very good. And oh, and what your dog hears, and it's blah, 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 Fifi, blah, blah. That's the ginger effect. And that's how I feel, you know, when anybody starts talking about sports. So they would take my man card away if we're going by these cliches just for that. You know, I'm not a particularly macho guy. But I was reading, in preparing for this thing I did for Alatea, I was reading, for reasons I don't even know why, but it was at Salon and it was some Harridan, I guess that's sexist now, talking about this whole idea about how men need to be detoxed from masculinity and how toxic masculinity is what's ruining society. And it was this, nobody denies that there are elements of macho culture that can be harmful, which is why we look at them as anomalies and we socially disapprove of things like strong arming, wife beating, you know, other kinds of loud, belligerent behavior that men more than women tend to engage in. That's not what they were saying. They were saying basically the functional, the normal attitude of men is toxic in and of itself. The idea that, honestly, we don't want to talk about our feels, you know, that there's a tendency to kind of be simpler about emotional issues that tend to be less complex. And that needs to go. We need to kind of, you know, make men more like women. And I'm just baffled as to why anybody would think a nation full of people prattling on about their feelings would be a better thing. But I think we see, you know, an underlying reality there in this church thing where the father kind of leads by example. And it's, people have made too much of this. It's the idea of the feminizing of the Catholic Church and that's what's driving men away. Usually when somebody writes upon the subject, they're not the people who should be writing on the subject because they've taken all the wrong messages away from it. But what happened post Vatican II? When did it happen? It happened in the 70s. What else did we get? We got EST, we got consciousness awareness, we got all of this new narcissism that started digging itself into the culture like a tick. And they merged. They merged in the church to create things like in my diocese, which I think spread to others. It was, you know, some program, well, I can't even remember the name of it, began with an A, in which, you know, you had to kind of own your faith and be in touch with the emotions and have this personal relationship with Jesus and all of this kind of stuff. And what I talk about is my dad's generation who would have only missed Mass or a holy day if they were missing a limb. You know, they came, right. They served, they were ushers, they cleaned the church. My father worked a soup kitchen until his late 80s. They did all these things, and I never once heard him talk about faith. Not once. You know, I don't think I saw him pray outside of grace, you know, and after communion, and he never sat with us at Mass. And I knew, yeah, well, he was an usher. So he was at the back, you know, getting ready to pass the basket and throwing people out or whatever ushers do. I always figure they're a kind of Catholic bouncer. But, you know, I knew hundreds of these men. Their faith was embedded in them. It was also unreflective, what we would call now, to a certain degree. And to a certain degree, the post-conciliar church told them that wasn't good enough anymore. That simple piety you have, that say your prayers, say your Hail Mary, work your rosaries, come to Mass, you know, wasn't good enough. And I think that's when we start seeing the erosion of male participation in Mass. Yeah. Tell me I'm wrong.
I couldn't say, because I entered the church in 1987.
Well, it was still pretty goofy then.
And I was not raised in a household where anybody went to church. My dad, as far as I know, my dad's whole exposure to the gospel consisted of, you know, some fire and brimstone sermons he heard when he was a little boy, and then that was it. Right. My mom was raised in an Anglican household in Canada, in the, you know, the 30s and 40s, but I don't think that they went to church. My grandpa was like super anti-Catholic. the highest form of praise that he could muster for a Catholic was, he's a nice fella for a Catholic. And, you know, he made one exception for Bing Crosby, right? Bing Crosby was okay, but yeah. And his only question when he learned that the man that my mom wanted to marry after their first date, which was, this is kind of one of those weirdly romantic stories. So my dad comes home from World War II on the Queen Mary. In like June or something of 1945, and he's just kind of knocking around. He's got nothing to do. He's fresh out of the Army Air Corps, and the war's over, and the world's at his feet, and he's footloose and fancy free, and so he goes up to Canada to hang around with his mom and his aunts, who owned this former hamburger stand that was now the cottage that sat on the shores of Lake Ontario. So he goes up there to just, I mean, it's, what better time to be alive than right after the war in 1945 and single. So he goes up there and he goes into a drugstore and he meets my mom. And he just took a shine to her. And so, romantic that he was, he asks her if she wants to come with him. She's the classic farm girl. He asks her if she wants to come with her and go help him pull night crawlers so he could go fishing, because he loves to fish, right? So that's fine with her. She wasn't squeamish about that stuff at all. So he held the flashlight while my mom pulled the nightcrawler, and he was so impressed with her that she was just, you know, she didn't put on airs and do any of that stuff, that he asked her to marry him on the spot, August 15th, 1945.
You find a woman who'll pull nightcrawlers for her, you marry that woman.
She's a fine woman.
You don't let that kind of woman go.
Don't let that kind of woman go. And so she says, you know, let me talk to my dad. And so she goes to my grandpa and says, Patrick Shea wants to marry me. His sole question to her
he's not
a Catholic, is he? After their first date, I'm just going, yeah, and the marriage lasted 38 years. They were happily married for 38 years, you know. So a total, don't try this at home, folks. But all of that is to say, not raised in an especially Christian household.
Right.
You know, had the kinds of issues that people of my generation had with people of my dad's generation. Right. So not a lot of overt affection. You know, you heard when you screwed up, but you didn't ever hear when you did things right, because right. Why should I praise you for doing the right thing? You're supposed to do the right thing. and so that was, you know, those things were formative, but in good and bad ways. I mean, there was, I eventually reached the point where I realized, because my own dad had just had a really tough upbringing. You know, his dad was an alcoholic and his parents divorced, and he remembered, you know, laying up at night listening to his parents scream at each other and all these things. And so when he got married, he swore that was not going to happen in his household. And I can tell you, I never, ever heard my dad raise his voice at my mother. Wow. It never happened. Shay, and we're going to be with Tom McDonald talking about fathers and families and
thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
I'm here with Mark Shea, and we are here today with Tom McDonald. I'm talking about the impact of fathers. It is, certainly in my own life, it was definitely the case. My father and my relationship with my father had a huge impact. Not all of it good, but then again, not all of it bad either. There are certain things that I believe in my bones that I'm certain that I got from my father. I was talking with a friend of mine the other day. Somebody said something nasty about her on the internet, and I remarked to her that it this brings out all of my most intensely 16th century instincts. with, you know, and I will do this. I mean, I do this even, you know, in the case of somebody was. Oh, you know, comparing Hillary Clinton to the female of the canine species.
And yes.
You don't do that.
It's just rude.
Yeah, you just don't do that. I mean, I don't even like her.
No, she's a completely detestable person, and that's fine to say that, but there's certain language
gentlemen
don't use, and the exactly. idea...
You know, and I got that from my dad. I owe that to my dad. And my dad, I was not given a Christian upbringing at all.
Right.
Just the whole Christian thing in my life is completely an adult decision and arrived at certainly partly because of moral influences from my parents, but not certainly from religious ones at all.
Right.
And so all of that is to say that a lot of the a lot of the sort of cultural history of the American Catholic Church is just not there for me. Right. Came into the church in 1987. And so my experience of the church, you know, comes there, and it comes, you know, through, you know, alloyed with all the accidents of locality and culture. So sure. My experience of the church was primarily the Archdiocese of Seattle in the late 1980s. But you know, even that, you know, some people go, how could you have ever become Catholic in the Archdiocese of Seattle? Right. You know? But my response to it at the time and still was I was extremely grateful to come into a part of the church that was so obviously and visibly all screwed up, because I'm obviously and visibly all screwed up.
Right. And so, you're perfect. You were made for each other.
Yeah. And so it was like, oh, well, this is, you know, this is a place where losers like me can fit in, because my experience as a non-denominational Protestant was very much of the kind of Darwinian. Oddly, it's funny. It's a subculture that doesn't believe in Darwin, but it lives an intensely Darwinian existence. So the question is always, are you pure enough? Did you really mean it when you became a Christian, and et cetera, et cetera? And the suspicion is always, no, you're not. And so we're going to have to split off from you in order to maintain our purity. And none of that is there, you know, the kind of the larger Catholic experience. The Catholic experience is welcome slobs, right?
Right. Right. And one of the things about the Catholic experience, especially with, you know, men of that generation and many men of many cultures that would never miss Mass, but also perhaps would never pick up a book about Catholicism on their own outside of Mass, you know, or attend a seminar or do any of that kind of stuff, is that their behavior in their worship was in itself efficacious for salvation, because if they believe, even at the most basic level, and that's, you know, what Catholicism has always taught, because they were evangelizing people of extremely varied grasps of theology, backgrounds, maturity levels. We baptize babies. The sacrament obviously has nothing to do with the baby knowing it. The sacrament conveys the grace on its own, the mechanism itself of the people of God, of the words said, bringing that child to the font conveys the grace. You know, the sacrament is the normal means of conveying that grace, and it's sealed more perfectly in confirmation as a choice as well. But the thing is, if you believe, I believe in Jesus as Lord, and you participate in the sacraments, you don't miss Mass, you go to confession, you take the Eucharist, you're good. Yeah. You don't have to, you know, I get this feeling with evangelicals that they're always interrogating themselves, like, do I really love Jesus enough? You know, do I really feel it? It's all about the gut to them.
One of the things I remarked to a friend of mine after I'd been Catholic for a few years was that it was remarkable to me how much more at ease I was in my relationship with Jesus now that I was no longer certain I was going to heaven. And and that's, you know, that really is the case. Now, anybody can fall into those kinds of puritanical patterns. And there are subcultures in the Catholic Church that have imbibed that kind of, puritanical purity testing kind of thing that goes on in the Catholic Church too. But it doesn't, it's a subculture, right, in the church. It's not the church. And so you can find, you know, a lot of places, there's all kinds of other issues that you have to struggle with, you know. And typically, in an average parish, I never have the sense, you know, the people sitting next to me in the pew are eyeballing me because did I wear the proper clothes, or did I bow low enough when I received the Eucharist, or did I do this trivial, you know, right, thing, or that nitnoid picky thing. But you know, in the subculture that I came from, there really were times where I felt as though all eyes were on me because I was not, doing whatever,
not moved by the spirit
tribal thing that I was supposed to be doing, you know? And, and so that's one of the nicer things about the faith. And of course, the other thing that the faith has, which my own upbringing didn't have, was it has the sacrament of confession.
Right.
Because it was a huge and haunting problem for me. As somebody who'd been taught, you know, things like once saved, always saved, you know, the question immediately becomes, you know, well, if that's true, then why am I still sinning?
Right.
You know, and every time I repent, you know, the question that would always haunt me was, well, did I really mean it? I don't know. Maybe I didn't, because I keep sinning. So maybe, you know, I mean, the heart is desperately wicked. Who can know it, says Jeremiah. And then I ran across Calvinist writers who were telling me, you're supposed to have an experience of irresistible grace.
Oh, stop.
And it was like, And then, you know, the question that would, of course, haunt me was, you have had an experience.
I know. How will I know it when I see it? Especially if there's only 120,000 getting in.
Yeah. So I'm filled with anguish about this stuff. And with combined with, you know, that with, you know, an upbringing in which, you know, in which your dad says things like, you know, when you screw up, I'll tell you, but, you know, no, I'm not going to, you know, compliment you when you do the right thing. And, you know, in which I could remember exactly two times in my entire life that my father said, I love you out loud. And one of them was spoken in anger.
No.
Yeah. And so you run into that kind of thing, and it can be, you know, there are people, and I can totally understand such people. You know, there are people who committed suicide in anguish over those kinds of things. The Sacrament of Reconciliation. That is to say, the Sacrament of Reconciliation is awesome.
Right. It is. Well, we have to remember, too, those men, your father, my father, came back from war-changed men.
Well, sure.
You know, they were taken at their, my father was, would have been 20 and 42 when he finally got, you know, his training in Mississippi, you know, and it was worlds he'd never seen before. He, you know, he would tell a story. This was a whole new thing. They were exposed to cultures in ways these punks who are whining about multiculturalism today have never been exposed. Foreign cultures, things just shot right into this stuff. My father used to tell a story about that's right. I can't tell this story now. I'll have to save it for another time because we're at the end. But there was limitations to that, you know, to that strong and silent, which is why you hope that, you know, what that generation experienced in the war that changed them, you know, that part of it we can do without, you know, the thing that caused them to button their emotions up because, you know, they just washed their friend out of a ball turret, you know,
happened,
you know, my father's aircraft was, so riddled with bullet holes that it was more patches than aircraft. You know, they got to the point where you couldn't even see the thing, and they'd been shot at so much, you know, at low altitude. So, you know, these are, and it's funny, you said your father came back on the Queen Mary. My father went over to Europe on the Queen Mary and came back on a garbage scow. And he said that was his entire experience of the war in like one event, one metaphor right there, you know.
Yeah.
You know, that's how he felt by the end.
Yeah.
And man,
you know, one thing I got to give to FDR, the GI Bill.
Yeah, of course.
Man, you know, I'm grateful that was done for those guys that came back from that. Cause, you know, the GIs who came back from World War I, you know, they wind up writing things like, brother, can you spare a dime? You know?
Yeah. Well,
and, so anyway, well, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today, Tom McDonald. And, I want to thank, Ethan Boland for, restraining himself and not being Rick Astley. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. We'll be back tomorrow. Bye.
Bye.